Fancy a game?
Tyler Bischoff is...
And are they both trying not to laugh at the word duty?
Yeah.
Technically correct.
Why is she speaking like...
Because they learned English from Professor Magoo over there.
Relax, we'll be in and out. Anyway, you've never seen my lab.
Oh, great. I get to see your nerd lab.
Hands up!
Hello, NHL Draft Lottery. Ryan Wallace will join us a little bit later. Plus, UNLV basketball plays tonight. They should win, I think. Jackson State. But Tony Sanchez has been fired. Thanks to UNLV for doing it at 11.05 a.m. right after our show went off the air. But with Sanchez officially gone, granted he will coach the last game of the year, question now for UNLV is who is next? And there's an important note to keep in mind during a UNLV coaching search under Desiree Reed-Francois. In college athletics, often the anonymous sources that give media members information for breaking news is the actual coach or athletic director involved in whatever situation that news is being broken about. There's a lot of benign stuff, like coaches can't talk about recruits until they're officially signed. So there'll be a lot of like recruiting info that's given from coaches to media because the coaches can't say anything on the record, but they want their recruiting covered. That makes recruiting easier when you can show, hey, look, people are already talking about you and you haven't even showed up here. So there's a lot of stuff that gets reported that the anonymous source is the actual coach or athletic director. Hell, the UNLV firing Tony Sanchez a few minutes before before the press release was put out saying Sanchez has been fired, there were a bunch of national media members that were tweeting out Tony Sanchez has been fired. It was probably Tony Sanchez that told them that. Like, there's a good chance it was a coach that told them that. So that happens a lot. That's how you get a lot of this anonymous information. Important to note for this process, Desiree Reed-Francois doesn't tell anybody anything. She's like as tight-lipped as it comes. So the reason you should keep that in mind is any sort of list, any sort of report on who UNLV is considering is not likely coming from within UNLV. It's usually going to be coming from the coaches themselves, which means either A, the coach might actually be a legitimate candidate, or B, a coach wants to be a candidate. Doesn't mean the coach actually is a candidate. And the phrase Desiree Reed-Francois used yesterday was there will be pure fiction about this coaching search. We saw it in basketball. We had reports. Reports might be too strong of a word, but we had reports of Thad Matta, Rick Pitino, and Mike Miller. Right? Guys that were not, they weren't even candidates. They weren't even real candidates. So don't fall for that again.
Sean Miller's brother.
Don't be morons. Like, both the Review Journal and the Sun have stories today about who the next candidate could be. I know that neither one of those are actually like Desiree Reed-Francois' list, right? That's just pure speculation by media members. The Athletic had two different writers put out stories and they listed like 20 different names between the two of them of who could be UNLV's next head coach. It's either speculation or it's the coaches saying, yes, I would be interested in that job or something like that. Now, with all that being said, I have two candidates that I'm cheering for. And I don't know if candidates might, that might be too strong of a word, but two that I'm cheering for completely selfish reasons. Jay Norvell from Nevada.
Excellent mustache.
And Nick Rolovich from Hawaii.
Fun dude.
Chris Vanini of The Athletic wrote a story on candidates, and he said, quote, UNLV could look in-state at Jay Norvell. I don't even know if Jay Norvell would be a good coach here. I don't know if Desiree Reed-Francois actually wants a coach from the Mountain West that I think he's won game above 500 so far in 3 years. But dear God, give me what ensues in this rivalry after a head coach leaves Nevada for UNLV. Jeff Horton did this in the 90s, but that was, it's like as old as UNLV's national title. That's like 25, 28 years ago, right? Nobody even remembers that anymore. Give it to me again in 2020. Like, and Jay Norvell is only making like $500,000, making less than Sanchez was making. You should be able to give him a raise. Had an 8-5 season last year. I think he's, what, 7-4 this year? Had some success, so you should be able to afford him. So technically correct, fully endorses Jay Norvell. Don't know if it would work. Don't know if it'd even be that exciting of a hire. But the pure hatred that would ensue from that, please.
I am all for making this rivalry more intense. We play for a cannon. Let's get it up. Come on.
The other awesome hire would be Nick Rolovich. Mike Grimala wrote a story saying UNLV should look at Nick Rolovich. Nick Rolovich is just pure fun. He's the guy that brings Elvis impersonators to Mountain West Media Days. It was a fortune teller this year at Mountain West Media Days. So he's just pure fun off the field. His offense on the field has been excellent. Lots of passing, deep passing too. Like, he's been very good at establishing a passing game. And his team is playing for the Mountain West title next week. So he's had success there at Hawaii, which when he took over, they weren't very good. So, and he's currently making $600,000 a year, same as Sanchez was. So you could conceivably afford Nick Rolovich. So those are the two candidates. Maybe they're not even real candidates, the technically correct ones. Not because they'd necessarily be the best, but because they'd give us the most fun content for the show.
Do we need to start a segment where we just pick one of these random candidates that are going to be floated across the ether? Like Butch Davis. Butch Davis will be the next head coach of UNLV.
We could go through. There's I've got a list of everyone the Athletic, the Sun, and the RJ has mentioned as a possible candidate. It's like 30-something names right now. We could at some point just go through all of those.
I want to do a segment called Pure Fiction.
Pure Fiction. Rich Rodriguez, Ole Miss offensive coordinator. So yesterday, Desiree Francois had her press conference. And she did not want to give very many specifics on the coaching search. If you remember when she fired Marvin Menzies, she gave a press conference. And the main specific detail that she gave us in that press conference was that she wanted the next UNLV head coach to be the highest paid coach in the Mountain West. Right? She gave us that. And they basically did that. I think Otzelberger might actually technically be number two this year, but he's got his contract. He gets a raise every year, so he has the most lucrative contract. But she didn't give us that for UNLV football. She did not give some sort of specific frame of reference for the salary of the next UNLV head coach. The only phrase she would say is very competitive in the Mountain West. So if we look at Mountain West salaries, there are four coaches in this conference that make more than $1.5 million a year. Gary Anderson at Utah State makes $900,000. Rocky Long at San Diego State makes $878,000. He's sixth, so that is the halfway point in the Mountain West. That's kind of my expectation, is that UNLV will try to pay somewhere where they can be middle of the road in the Mountain West, between $800,000 and like $1.1, $1.2 million. That is my expectation. Desiree Francois yesterday, she almost said something because she was asked about
pay. That's very out of character.
She was asked about pay, and she said, we're going to be competitive. And then she started to say, the words that came out of her mouth were, we're going to be in. And then she stopped her sentence and said, we're going to be competitive in the Mountain West. And I feel like she was about to say, we're going to be in the top half of the Mountain West, or the top third of them. Like, I feel like she was going to give some sort of frame of reference within the conference and then stopped herself and just said very competitive. So if we assume a little bit, I think they're going to be trying to pay their coach in the top half of the Mountain West, which would mean you're trying to pay around $900,000 or more. And that's probably the most important part of this coaching search. How much can they pay? Because if you're only paying your head coach $600,000, like Tony Sanchez was, you can't give very many guys raises to come to UNLV. Like, most power conference coordinators are making close to that, if not much more, than $600,000 a year. But if you can offer $900,000 a year, that ups your candidate pool a little bit. But maybe not even enough. You might even have to be over a million, because two of the names the Athletic threw out, one was Oregon's offensive coordinator, Marcus Arroyo. He's making $825,000 at Oregon. Would he really take a $75,000 raise to come be UNLV's head coach? Probably not. Marcus Scali, also mentioned by the Athletic, he's Utah's defensive coordinator. He's also making $825,000. Is he leaving to become UNLV's head coach for a $75,000 raise? Probably not.
Alabama's strength and conditioning coach makes,
he makes way more than Sanchez.
He makes $585,000 a year.
Okay, so they can give him a $15,000 raise.
Yes.
and be very, very strong?
Very strong. Alabama strong.
Now, but if you're looking at candidate pool and trying to figure out the pay part of this, if you go to the FCS level, Jay Hill from Weber State's a name that's been tossed around a lot already. He's only making $275,000 a year. So you can absolutely entice that guy to come to UNLV solely based on the money, because if you're able to offer $800,000-$900,000, that's a significant raise from $275,000. Or another name the Athletic mentioned was Dennis Simmons, who's Oklahoma's wide receivers coach. He's making $460,000, right? If you're able to offer $800,000-$900,000 a year, that's doubling his pay, basically. That's absolutely could be seen as worth it for a coach, even though UNLV is a very, very tough job. So the pay, I think, is going to be the important part. My expectation is that it comes in between that $800 and $1.2 million range, but we'll see. How'd you feel about her no timetable comment?
Not great.
So it's the same comment she gave for the basketball search. Fired Marvin Menzies, said there's no timetable for their coaching search. 12 days later was when they announced TJ Altsberger. So it wasn't very long, but it was almost 2 weeks there. And I kind of am expecting a similar timeline here. She's gone out of her way to make a point and say there's no timetable for her searches. So that's definitely something she wants to avoid, is putting any sort of artificial deadline on herself. So then, you know, if you say, oh, we need to have a coach hired in 2 weeks, and then you don't have one hired in 2 weeks, it looks bad. And you're the only reason it looks bad. But I do think there is an artificial deadline. December 18th through December 20th is the early signing period for college football. I think UNLV has to have a coach in place before that. I think they, like, and it can't be December 17th. Like, I think they have a coach in place so that that coach can actually go and sign some players in December. There's still the signing period in February. You can still finish up your class then. But the fear is, A, you've got 11 kids committed to UNLV. If you don't have a coach in place by that early signing period, there's a chance they flip on you and sign somewhere else. And if you don't bring a coach in, that coach has no chance to even keep the 11 kids that are committed to UNLV, because somebody else flipped them on early signing day. And then the other option is you get a new coach in, and maybe he could flip somebody if you get him in before the early signing period. If he comes in afterwards, kids are going to already be signed, and there's no chance to flip them because they're signed, and that's, it's done after that point. So to me, it's, that's sort of your deadline. It's, I don't know, what, a week before then or something like that? Like, you need to have something in place a little bit before that early signing period so the new coach has a chance to keep the guys that are already committed and maybe go steal a couple of other kids in that early signing period. This is the first UNLV coaching hire with the new early signing period. Like, it's, I think it's, what, the second year they've had it. So this is new to hiring a coach. You've never had to really worry about signing kids at the same time as you're trying to hire a head coach. You normally have a couple of months. That's different now.
Are we hiring a consulting firm?
Yes, they are using a search firm. The way Desiree Reed-Francois described it yesterday is they just sort of are there as a resource, and that she is the one driving the bus on the actual search. There's a...
Okay, because the last time we did a coaching search, it wound up having to involve subterfuge and her husband spying on somebody. I didn't know what the, like, group that we were paying a la carte was doing.
Tune in tomorrow when we go through all of the locations that Daktronics is located at to narrow down which candidates Desiree Francois' husband can spy on. Tenderly Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Make sure you place your bets at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long every Monday night. Bourbon Street Lounge will host football viewing parties with giveaways, including jerseys. It is Technically Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from beconnectedsports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app, and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
The Golden Knights are 3-6-4 since October 28th.
That is the day they sent Jake Bischoff back to the AHL. 3 wins in 13 games since then. They have gotten what they deserved. The third worst record in the NHL. In that time period, they've also given up the fourth most high danger chances in the NHL. So they definitely need some defensive enhancement.
They also had a goal they gave up last night because two defensemen were on the wrong side.
So here's what I'm curious about with the Golden Knights. What can Gerard Gallant actually do as far as like changing the lineup or bringing up new players? Like, obviously, I want them to call up Jake Bischoff. Jake Bischoff playing instead of Nick Hague or John Merrill does not make the Golden Knights Stanley Cup contenders. Like, that's not fixing the problems. Moving Cody Eakin up to second line center is not fixing the team, right? Scratching Derek Englund is not fixing the team. Like, in the most simplistic way possible, it just feels like the good players on the Golden Knights need to actually, you know, be good.
Well, I mean, I think, and we'll talk to Ryan Wallace about this next, but honestly, I feel like the good players are trying to be good.
Well, I don't think they're not trying to be good.
No, I'm saying like they're taking lots of shots. They're just not succeeding.
It's a strange scenario where the Golden Knights still have excellent analytics. They're getting more shots than their opponents on average. They're getting better chances than their opponents on average. They just aren't winning, like, because they're not finishing. And their save percentage hasn't been great recently, pretty much regardless of who's in goal. So, I don't know. It's very strange. I just don't think, like, as much as lineup changes are, like, that's what we tend to focus on, I don't know how much it actually matters, because you just need William Karlsson to score goals. Like, you just need Mark Stone to score goals. Like, that's what you need this team to do, and the best players on this team aren't doing it at a high enough rate.
Has Jonathan Marchessault just disappeared, or am I crazy?
Kind of. I mean, the goal scoring part of it, absolutely. Like, they have not been
hits,
good.
I think last night, didn't they?
They have not. Like, nobody on this team. Like, Riley Smith was good early. Max Pacioretty's been pretty good lately, but that's pretty much it as far as goal scoring. Mark Stone's been pretty good the whole year. Like, he's been solid. But those are really the only three players you can point at and say, yeah, they're of the top six forwards on this team. Yeah, they're having a good season. And really, you can't even point to the whole season for Riley Smith or Max Pacioretty. It's just sort of been here and there. Karlsson, Marchessault, Paul Stastny.
What are you doing?
And maybe I'm thinking of anecdotal evidence here, but it just felt like the last 2 years there would be at least one play every two or three games where it was just Jonathan Marchessault going, okay, give me the puck. I'm going to go score.
He shoots all the time. Like, yeah. That's what his MO has been since he's been a Golden Knight, is he's just going to always launch it, and his shooting percentage is dismal right now.
Hunter Renfroe has a broken rib and a punctured lung.
Yeah, he took a hard hit on Sunday. It did some damage. He also came back into the game after...
He's a hard worker.
...apparently puncturing his lung. Gruden, the only timetable Gruden said was that he would be out a while. So...
It's down to one lung.
Yeah, understandable. But I don't know what a while means. That could be the rest of the season, honestly.
Whenever he has two functioning lungs, we'll let him play.
Renfroe is the top wide receiver on this team in terms of targets. Fun fact, he also has the longest reception of the year at 65 yards. So now, who is Derek Carr throwing to?
Darren Waller.
It should be, but Darren Waller, first 6 games of the year, 7.3 catches per game, 81 yards per game. Last 5 games, 5.6 catches per game, 44 yards per game. So Darren Waller's production has kind of been cut in half recently, and it feels like the Raiders need to scheme stuff up for Darren Waller. Like, it's like last week, they ran a wheel route for Derek Carrier.
Okay.
He's the third tight end.
He's the blocking tight end.
He's behind Foster Moreau on the tight end depth chart. They ran a wheel route for him, and Derek Carr actually threw a decent pass. Carrier only put up one arm, and it went off his one arm, and he did not make a one-armed catch because he's the third-string tight end on the team. Like, do that for Darren Waller. He might go up and catch it with two hands.
except, and break a tackle and score a touchdown.
Except if you run a wheel route for Darren Waller, that's almost a tongue twister, the defense would go, oh, there's Darren
they
Waller.
They covered him. They covered Derek Carrier. It wasn't like he was wide open. He had a man right on him. The reason he couldn't put his other arm up is because there was a defender right there.
Oh, wow. All
right. It wasn't a wide open wheel route that he just missed. He was covered. Run it for Darren Waller. That guy could actually go up and beat a defensive back or a linebacker and make a catch. So it feels like they need to go out of their way to make Darren Waller more involved, because especially with Renfro out, are you throwing to Tyrell Williams? Are you throwing to Zay Jones? Like, those are your other options. Like, I don't know. To me, it's just they need to force it to Darren Waller at this point.
And my question is, why aren't they using Zay Jones as a just DeSean Jackson, just run down the field?
Those are not allowed.
Okay. I didn't read the rules.
Deep pass is not allowed in John Gruden's offense.
UNLV had 17,373 fans at Sam Boyd Stadium on Saturday.
The season average attendance at Sam Boyd this year was 19,864. That highest of the Tony Sanchez era. It's also the highest for UNLV football since 2011, which is actually fairly impressive. My question is, what's the attendance next season?
Oh, mine was, should we leave a stadium every year?
They had nearly 20,000 this year. They had no bowl hopes for pretty much the entire second half of the season. You had a relatively assumed lame duck coach for the second half of the season. So how much higher can the attendance climb next year when you're in a new stadium and you have a new coach that you can hype up before the year and some higher profile game, because Cal and Arizona State are both coming here? Will those fan bases travel significantly enough to help your attendance? We've talked about it before, but UNLV's expenses for Allegiant Stadium are estimated to be two or three times higher than what they're paying to run Sam Boyd on a game day. So simple math, you're going to need to have two or three times the amount of fans in attendance. Higher ticket prices could offset how many more fans you need. But my one concern, or why I don't think the attendance is going to be significantly higher next year, is part of the reason they had an attendance bump this year is they had a season ticket special where if you bought season tickets this year at Sam Boyd, you were guaranteed that price next season at Allegiant Stadium. So I feel like they've maxed out the season tickets they're going to sell at Allegiant Stadium. I don't feel like they're going to have a big push of season ticket buyers going into Allegiant Stadium next year, because you already missed out on the special deal that they had, unless they do another special deal and people are like, oh, that's even better. But I don't know how much better it's going to be. They're not going to get to 30,000, are they?
I mean, if they go full on this first season, we are a minor league baseball team.
And that doesn't help them. Like, it's not just about the amount of people in the stadium. It's about the actual money you make from it. So if gave everybody a $1 ticket.
You sponsor the
field. Well, we're the only ones offering to sponsor the field, and we've got $62.
Whoa, you have $60?
Yeah, I stole it from you.
Oh. I honestly think they could get to 30,000, but it's going to have to be at a loss, or they could have 20,000 and they find ways to generate revenue.
But I don't know that it'll be enough revenue. Like, it's not going to be.
It may
enough.
Not. That's why you bring in a new basketball coach in order to supplement the income of the stadium you can't fill. Talk to you about that comment. Malcolm Subban is 0-4-2 on the season.
Can't get a win. The Golden Knights haven't won a game with any goalie not named Fleury in net. Fleury, by the way, 11 wins, 8 losses on the season. Not entirely great either. But at 5-on-5, Malcolm Subban's save percentage is .914. Marc-Andre Fleury is .915. Like, they're basically the same stopping the puck at 5-on-5. The difference is on the penalty kill, where Marc-Andre Fleury still leads the NHL in penalty kill save percentage at .946. Malcolm Subban is .813. Subban would be bottom five. He hasn't played enough games to qualify, but Subban would be bottom five in that stat. Fleury's the best. So they're around league average when it comes to 5-on-5, but killing penalties, Fleury is the best in the league. Subban, one of the worst so far.
Is that a comment on the special teams, or is that just a comment on Subban in general?
I don't know.
Awesome. Okay. Are we going to have to ask Ryan?
Yes.
Okay. Good thing we're previewing that coming up. UNLV is 0-5 against teams ranked 160 or better in KenPom.
There's some moral victories for you. No Mountain West team has more than one win over top 160 teams. The rest of the Mountain West is 7-14 against top 160 teams. Nevada's 1-3, Boise State 1-2, Fresno State 0-2. Those are the teams that have played more than one. UNLV, they haven't played extremely well, but I think if you're just looking at the record right now, especially if you're comparing it to other Mountain West schools, it's probably not a fair comparison at the moment because the Mountain West doesn't have a lot of teams with good wins on the season. Now, again, if you were planning to go to an NCAA tournament, right, losing those games to Cal and Kansas State, like those would hurt you a lot. Texas State, like those would hurt because either A, they could be viewed as bad losses, or B, they could have been quality wins. But at the end of the day, UNLV is not playing for the NCAA tournament. And losing a close game to Kansas State, while T.J. Altsberger doesn't want any more moral victories, it is a moral victory, and it's probably fine. And if you're trying to compare to the rest of the Mountain West, losing to Kansas State in overtime is as good as pretty much any other result in the Mountain West at the moment. But if you look at other teams' schedule, like take Utah State, for example. They did beat LSU. Great win. They were down, I think, 18 in that game, came back to beat LSU. But their other games this season by KenPom rank, 234, 274, 304, 326, 216. UNLV would be 5-1 against Utah State's schedule.
Wow. All right.
Like they would. They would absolutely be 5-1 against that schedule. They'd lose to LSU, but they would absolutely beat 274 in KenPom. Right. They would do that. So right now, just simply looking at record isn't a great way to actually evaluate UNLV. The way they've actually played in those games, that might be something different, like the Texas State one, not that encouraging. Right? But Kansas State one is a little bit encouraging. So don't get too caught up in the, 2-4 record for your 2-5 record for UNLV right now. It's not as bad as it would seem across the Mountain West. Ryan Wallace will join us next. Do you think he's got an answer for how to fix the Golden Knights?
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
I didn't ask him last night. Today, I was told he's sick, not eating, puking. You want me to go into the whole tire tread as far as what happened today with him so we can get that speculation done with as far as that he's going to be moved? He shit his pants, he was puking, he was doing everything. So, enough.
Tyler Bischoff is technically correct.
Ryan Wallace is here.
Hi.
VGK Insider Show, that's what, 3-4? That sounds right, doesn't it?
I don't know. You're the host of this one. Shouldn't you have that all figured out?
No, that's no? Irrelevant. I know what time my show starts.
That's fine.
Yeah, 3-4. Fox Sports Las Vegas. So, what's wrong with the Golden Knights? How are you fixing this team? Why can't they win?
Well, they can't score.
All right.
So that's
good job.
That's
all right,
number one.
We got it figured out.
Can't score.
Why can't they score?
Their top six players are getting opportunities, but for, you know, the better part of a week and a half, Cody Eakin was considered a top six player, and I think that's a problem. Now, it did jumpstart Cody Eakin. However, it cooled off Paul Stastny. And for whatever reason, Cody Glass, Alex Tuch, they don't seem to have the chemistry I think we all kind of expected them to or hoped that they would. So third line is still doing absolutely nothing. They had a disaster of a game last night. And then the fourth line, I think, has been the best line for the Golden Knights night in and night out. And that tells you all you need to know about the Golden Knights and their inability to score. Now, how can it improve? How can it get better? Well, they could start by holding onto the puck when they have it. They have just terrible puck management lately. They're not necessarily getting into those dangerous areas because every time they try to make a pass into the middle of the ice, it's either deflected or kicked out, or there's some type of miscue. So they're just a team right now that's not in sync with each other, and they're not a five-man unit moving up the ice.
So they have one of the 10 worst records in the NHL right now. The Sharks passed them last night for the final wild card spot in the West. How confident are you that they are going to end up in the playoffs?
Well, I mean, they're still, what, 1 point out of a wild card spot right now, and they've been pretty dismal to start the year. So until those teams above them really start to create some separation, I think they'll be okay so long as they start winning some games. But the St. Louis Blues have forever skewed what makes sense in the NHL in terms of how far back you have to be in order to be considered out of it. So Golden Knights fans will probably take solace in the fact that the Blues went from worst to the Stanley Cup final to the eventual Stanley Cup champions, and they were in last place in January of the year that they won it. So I guess you can kind of say give it till January, maybe mid-January, but legitimately...
No. What about like December 30th?
Hanukkah. Yes. I know what you're getting at. Like, I get it. I understand. It has worked for 2 years.
That is so enough of a sample
that's
size.
That is the largest for two years.
That is the largest sample size and the most true thing we know. So yes, Jared, if the Golden Knights are in a playoff spot by the end of Hanukkah, they will make the playoffs.
All right.
December 30th.
Yeah, why is it so late this year?
It's the Jewish calendar.
It's a lunar calendar.
It's very fluid.
Very fluid. Listen to this. So the Oilers are 9 points clear.
Mm-hmm.
Is that far enough away that you say the Golden Knights can't really win the division?
It's the Oilers, so no.
All right.
I mean, let's be honest. The Oilers were very good when they played the Golden Knights over the weekend. They were really, really good. However, the Oilers are one Connor McDavid or one Leon Draisaitl injury away from being mediocre at best. So as long as those two guys stay healthy...
But they have James Neal.
Okay, yeah. Sure they do. They were great. James Neal was fantastic.
Did the James Neal lose in the Stanley Cup final take a year off, but it's back this year?
I think that it was more of the fact that James Neal was playing for Bill Peters, who's historically a bad hockey coach.
All right.
Honestly, like that's what I think it was.
Okay.
Like James Neal, all he does is score goals. Let's bury him on the fourth line. That makes a ton of sense.
Ooh,
Very logical.
That's what they should do with Nikita Gusev. That's what they have been doing with Nikita Gusev.
Is that what New Jersey's doing?
He at one point was playing on the fourth line. Jeez. Then they healthy scratched him. Yeah. Gave him a bunch of defensive zone starts.
That makes total sense.
Yeah, that's exactly what you do with Nikita Gusev.
Best suited for his skill set, for sure.
Do you think Malcolm Subban will ever win another game as a Golden Knight?
No. I want to believe, but every time I do, it's just like, unless he gets a shutout, because he's not getting more than one or two goals a game. And, like, legitimately, he's not. So the best argument that I had last night was somebody pointing out on Twitter that if Malcolm Subban had just made the saves he needed to make or should have made in that game, it would have been 2-2 and they would have gone to, you know, overtime and the Golden Knights would have gotten a point. And then I look back to the Oilers game and I say, if Marc-Andre Fleury doesn't go chasing Connor McDavid out of the corner on the first goal, and if Marc-Andre Fleury doesn't allow an Ethan Bear shot that he can see trickle below his pad, then the Golden Knights would have gotten at least a point out of that Edmonton game. But you can't point that out because Marc-Andre Fleury is the best ever and Malcolm Subban is the worst goalie that ever existed. So, you know, it's the dichotomy of wins and losses and hate and love for goaltenders that just really gets my blood boiling. It's so fun. I love Twitter.
What could Gerard Gallant actually do as far as lines go? Because I don't tend to believe any sort of lineup change is going to make that big of a difference. Like moving Eakin around, scratching Englund, calling up Jake Bischoff. I don't think any of that's actually going to like fix the team and all of a sudden they're great because he made a couple of changes.
Well, here's the problem with the changes. The changes, I think, in terms of defense, have kind of screwed everything up. So you sit Derek Englund, you don't touch Merrill and Holden. Merrill and Holden continue to have a good game. Then John Merrill just forgets how to play hockey for a game and against Washington. And then there's this rotation now with Holden, Merrill, and Englund. And I don't think any of those guys have been able to find the form that they had earlier on in the season. Derek Englund excluded because he hasn't found form all season. But my point is Merrill and Holden have not been very good since they have been scratched in and out of the lineup. And that, to me, is a problem. Nick Hague and Shea Theodore is fine. However, you still have those moments where Nick Hague is a rookie in the NHL and he makes rookie plays. He did so multiple times in the Edmonton game and it led to goals against, and That's not necessarily going to be good enough. And then in terms of offense, I think Cody Glass is tired. Again, this is a kid that is not used to an 82-game schedule. Like,
they've only played like 26.
Well, sure, I get it. But like, he's just not used to the rigors of the NHL just yet. He didn't play a full season in the AHL last year. He joined for the playoff run. That was about it. Like, that's his cup of coffee, right? So I think you maybe look at sitting Cody Glass for a game or two or three just to kind of give him a break, give him a breather. Or, I don't know, here's a crazy idea. You play Cody Glass at center just to see what happens.
Boo.
Just to see what happens. I know
not
it's
allowed.
Crazy. Like, I get it. I totally
do. You have
do.
To play your rookies out of position.
But my point is, we've seen everything else. Right, like we've seen Cody Eakin second line center, so I guess like we could see Cody Eakin first line center, maybe. I don't know. Sure, why not?
It should. But, William Karlsson, that guy, he can't score. Might as well get him out of there.
But if you're willing to jumpstart Cody Eakin by playing him alongside Jonathan Marchessault and Mark Stone or Max Pacioretty and Mark Stone, why are you not also willing to jumpstart Cody Glass by doing the same thing?
Since the top six forwards aren't scoring, don't you think they're shooting too much?
You like that call, eh?
Yeah.
That was so fun. Yeah, so we had a caller last night that called in and told me that the top six forwards are just shooting the puck, but they're not scoring, and therefore are not doing their job. Well, I understand results are important. You can't actually score without shooting, so.
Are you sure about that?
Well, Mark Stone scored a goal this year without shooting, so technically I guess you can
so you
do
should
it.
Do that more
it's
often
just, it's just not a high percentage play. Like hitting a post and then having a defenseman put the puck in his own net is not a high percentage play.
I don't know, it sounds like it worked.
Taking 11 shots in a game is a higher percentage play of actually putting one in the back of the net, which Max Pacioretty attempted 11 shots last night. And I understand a lot of people want to question someone's heart or character or effort or whatever. You can't do that with Pacioretty. Like, he's been far and away the most consistent forward for the Golden Knights, game in, game out. He's bringing it, whatever it is. I don't think that you can question whether or not he cares.
All right, I've got a Mike Babcock story for you.
Oh, yes.
This is from the Toronto Sun.
Okay.
During the 2016-17 season, Mike Babcock was alleged to have asked one of the Leafs rookies to list the players on the team from hardest working to those who, in the eyes of the rookie, did not have a strong work ethic. The rookie did so, not wanting to upset his coach, but was taken aback when Babcock told the players who had been listed at the bottom.
That rookie was Mitch Marner. Oh, I know the story. Come on.
How great is that?
It's fantastic. I mean, it's horrible. It's a bad thing to do to a 19-year-old kid who's trying to make it in the NHL. But, I mean, it's you've seen Mike Babcock. Like, you've heard him talk. We just got to keep grinding. You know what I mean? Like, he's just that guy. He's a good player. He's okay. I don't like him. But, like, if you're Mitch Marner, what do you do in that situation?
You can't say no. I mean, good, right?
There was a tweet earlier this morning that in Detroit, some of the stars on the teams during the Mike Babcock years every year would go to Ken Holland and try to get him fired. And Ken Holland was like, no, we're not doing that. I love the post-firing airing of grievances. It's
wonderful.
But it's been like everybody now with Mike Babcock. Like, everyone is
every job he's ever been fired from.
Fundamentally saying, like, yeah, this guy's kind of a jerk. It's an epidemic.
He's Ryan Wallace, VGK Insider Show, 3 to 4 on Fox Sports Las Vegas, and the pregame, intermission, and postgame show. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, guys.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler. Tyler Bischoff is
technically correct. The best kind of correct.
TJ Otzelberger says he's done with moral victories, but are you ready for a real victory?
Yeah.
They play Jackson State. The schedule is here to give you a real victory. Jackson State is 1-5 on the year. Their only win is over Southern New Orleans. Jackson State's KenPom is 3-19. So a loss here would be pretty indefensible, even in the first year for TJ Otzelberger. But there's one thing I'd like to see beyond a win or an easy win, and this is when they should start playing fast. UNLV is 327th in tempo. They have completely under-delivered on whatever promises Otzelberger was making in the offseason about playing fast and playing with tempo. But the next two games, on Saturday, they're going to play Cincinnati. Cincinnati, top 100 in tempo this season. Jackson State, they're right dead average in the country as far as possessions per game. So far this year, all but one of UNLV's opponents are bottom 100 in tempo. So UNLV's been dragged down by slower opponents. That should not happen against Jackson State. A, Jackson State doesn't play particularly slow, and B, you'd like to think UNLV can sort of impose its will on a Jackson State type of team. So I want to see them playing faster tonight. They don't have to play like 85 possessions, which would make you the fastest team in the country, but they're around like 65 at the moment. Get into the 70s.
79, under, over.
Under.
77, under, over.
Under.
72?
Over.
Okay.
75. Like, all let's right. Let's have a slightly decent game as far as tempo goes, and then do it again on Saturday when you play Cincinnati, who actually is a fairly fast team. Now, there is one reason to think they won't be able to get into transition against Jackson State. That is because Jackson State is good at one thing. They don't turn the ball over. Jackson State doesn't shoot well. They don't rebound well. They don't defend the rim very well. They don't do anything very well except they don't turn the ball over very much. Getting turnovers leads to fast break opportunities, speeds the game up. So that is one reason to think that Jackson State won't actually allow UNLV to have a very fast game, but I don't care. Get some transition baskets. Actually, it's not even so much the transition. It's in the half court, score in the first 10 seconds of the shot clock, like Otzelberger talked about before the season started. That doesn't happen for this team. This team, every half court possession is grinding it out. A lot of that is because of the talent, and they can't actually get the looks they want to get early in the shot clock, but get some against Jackson State. Actually get some good shots early in the shot clock against a lesser opponent like Jackson State. That's what I want to see. Now, as far as the lineup goes, we have not seen Jonah Antonio for the last couple of games. Otzelberger has not had media availability ahead of this game, so we don't have an actual update. He's just been listed as questionable recently. We do know that he got hurt before the Cal game, but played through it. He actually shot 3 of 5 against Cal, then 0 of 1 against UCLA, then 1 of 7 against Abilene Christian, and then they decided to sit him down after that game. So questionable. He could play tonight. Might not see him until Saturday. Might be even longer than that. But it is his non-shooting hand. And he was dressed for the last couple of games, just didn't actually get into the game, didn't actually go through warm-ups. They need shooters. Like, more than anything, they need shooters. Like, this recruiting class they have coming up, you got to hope all 6 of those guys can shoot.
Hey, but tell us Scheibel's a shooter.
Is he? Are we sure he hasn't made a 3 yet? Because he was stepped on the line for that one long 2.
But, I mean, he's still putting them up.
Yeah, so Vitaly Scheibel started last game, which was interesting. He played 28 minutes, scored 4 points, didn't make any of his 3s. He did have 7 rebounds. Here's the thing with Scheibel starting, though. I'm not a huge fan of it because Scheibel's value is the spacing he provides when he plays center. When you put him at power forward next to Mbaki Zhang, the helpfulness of his spacing is less effective because normally you already have Donnie Tillman playing power forward, and Donnie Tillman already gives you that level of spacing. So I'm not 100% on board with Scheibel in the starting lineup playing next to Mbaki Zhang for big minutes. I like it more as, hey, Mbaki Zhang's going to play 30 minutes. Vitaly Scheibel's going to play the other 10 as your backup center. We'll see. I will say Scheibel's biggest deficiency is defense. Like, SMU targeted Scheibel. They went after Scheibel quite a few times. So playing him with Mbaki Zhang should conceivably clean that up. But they really need Antonio back. Even if he doesn't make that many threes, they just need the pure threat of somebody that can knock down a 3.
Some of y'all football sucks.